They are in Ephraim.
And up there. All right, and then we have who's next?
Gideon.
Good. And where is Gideon found? Okay. All right. There you go. All right. What do we got next? Number six. I think I heard it. All right. And where?
Shamir.
All right. Who's next? Jair. Anybody remember where Jair's from?
Come on.
That's right. All right. And after Jair? We got Jephthah. Good. And where's Jephthah from?
Gilead.
Good. From off Gilead. And then after Jephthah? Ibzan. And who we have? Where is that from? Anybody remember?
Bethlehem.
Good. All right. And then after Ibzan?
Elon.
And where is Elon? South Georgia. Zebulun. All right, and then after Elon? Athen. And where's Athen?
Yeah.
Yep. And then our last one? Samson. All right, anybody remember? Where's Samson? Yep. Okay, good. Good. So as we get closer to the end of the session, we should start to stick, hopefully. So, all right. So, outline for the judges. We have the conditions in Israel, and then what's the next section? The judges. And then after that? Cultural decline. All right. And then we have the cycle that we keep going through. Who can tell me the steps in that cycle? What do we start with?
Sin.
All right. And so after sin, what ends up happening to the people? They end up in servitude, followed by supplication. So they lift up their voice. And what happens after that? Salvation. So God provides a judge or a deliverer. And then what follows that?
Period of rest.
And then what happens? It starts all over again after the judge passes. So there's that cycle we see over and over here in the book of Judges. Okay. So we find ourselves in Samson, which is the very end of this section before we get into more about the cultural decline. So what we're going to go ahead and do is jump in a little bit on Samson. So who can tell me a little bit about Samson's family? What do we know about him here in the first couple of verses of chapter 13?
He's a Danite.
Okay, he was a Danite. And he was, his father was from where? Zora. Right? All right. And what was his father's name? Manoah. All right. Anything else we know about the family?
No children and older.
I'm sorry?
No children.
No children. Yep. And how do we know there weren't any other children? Good. So they were. She's listed as barren and had no other children. So obviously that would bring that to there.
All right, anything else about the family stick out there? I don't think so. Okay. So, what happens? What happens in these next couple verses following that after we get a description of the family?
An angel shows up.
All right, so we have an angel. And the angel gives some instructions to Samson. So what instructions do we see here in these verses? I'm sorry? Oh, I'm sorry. To his mother. My apologies.
She's to abstain from anything from the fruit of the vine.
Okay. So she is not to drink any wine or any fermented drink. What else do we have? What are
not to eat anything unclean.
Okay. Nothing unclean. And then what do we have in verse 5? All right, and then no razor is to come to his head. All right, so we see something, we get a lot more information if we go into Numbers, a little bit about what's happening here. So he's going to become a Nazirite. So that's the basic set of information here. Let's flip back to Numbers 6 and take a look at that. Numbers 6, starting in verse 1. Whoever gets there first, if you go ahead and read 1 through 9 for me.
It says, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say, when either a man or woman consecrates an offering to take a vow, or a Nazirite to separate himself from the Lord, he should separate himself from wine and all similar drink. He should drink neither vinegar made from wine, nor vinegar made from any similar drink. Neither shall he drink any grape juice, nor eat fresh grapes or raisins. All the days of the separation he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine from seed to stem. All the days of the vow and separation, no razor shall come upon his head, until the days are fulfilled for which he has separated himself to the Lord. He shall be holy. Then he shall let the locks of the hair of his head grow. All the days that he separates himself from the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body. He shall not make himself unclean even for his father or his mother or his brother or sister, when they die because the separation to the God is on his head. All the days of the separation shall be holy to the Lord. And if anyone dies or is suddenly discarded, and he defiles his consecrated head, and he shall shave his head on the day of his cleansing. On the seventh day he shall shave it.
Okay. So, we once again see here in Numbers what the basic instructions are. In verse 3, to separate himself from wine and similar drink, and have nothing to do with grape juice, no grapes, no raisins, eat nothing from skin to seed, and then again, no razor shall come upon his head. So do we see any differences between the Nazirite vow here in Numbers and what's being asked of Samson's mother?
Pretty much consistent. A little more explicit in Numbers in some respects, but
okay.
It lines up pretty much even.
Anybody else think of anything that's different?
She's doing it from birth. I mean, it's like he's not made that decision.
Yep.
This is a decision the parents have made for him.
Okay, so she's being instructed to do this on his behalf from the womb. So it's not just a vow that someone takes for a short period of time. That's the other big difference I see here is, here in Numbers, it's a short-term constriction versus what we're seeing in Judges on Samson's behalf is to be his whole life. So.
Well, in the Numbers, it talks about being holy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And her instructions, it doesn't seem like that. It's something that I think is forced on him.
Okay.
From his action.
Sure. Anybody else have any other thoughts on that?
Yeah. In Judges, the angel says not to eat anything unclean, and that's kind of like the idea of ending like animals and stuff, but the Numbers, it doesn't actually say that.
True.
The grapes.
Okay, and then the not touch dead bodies, which would make you unclean, but it's not as specific about eating anything unclean. Good. It's another difference.
Yeah, we make a big deal about the, probably right, about the lion being dead and getting honey out there. You know, it does leave out the dead body thing in your Judges, but maybe by inclusion, saying it's a Nazarite vow, that's a lot. But maybe the honey being in the lion, I don't know if the lion meat is clean anyway, so maybe it covers that.
That's a good question. I didn't think about that one.
If you kill a bunch of people, that's one of the reasons some people think, you know, leave out the dead body stuff.
Yeah, Ken.
And he was kind of wild, you can tell from the kind of people he hung around with. So even though it's told he'll be a Nazarite, so it's there in verse 5, he may not have taken all experience.
Yeah. Something that was done on his behalf and not necessarily something he seemed as inclined to live up to. It's very true.
By all indication, his parents tried to teach him.
Very true.
You know, that is, I think, kind of sticks out in my mind as I was reading through again several times asking that angel, okay, how are we to raise this child? And all indications, they were following that.
Good. So let's get in a little bit on the motivation of his parents. So that's a good segue, Danny. Verse 8. So what did Manoah say in his prayer?
Well, he asked the angel to come. The Lord sent the angel back so that he could find out how they should act and what they should do.
Yeah. So he's looking for a little more detail. He's wanting more info, kind of break it up a little bit more. And we see more about his motive in verse 12, where he says, when your words are fulfilled, what is to be the rule for the boy's life and work? So he wants more info. And does the angel provide him with any of that? Not really. Yeah, he gives him the same instruction.
I guess if you count the sign as being a confirmation, it's not information, more information, but it's a confirmation.
Sure.
The fact that he appeals to Jehovah is interesting. There's a lot of evidence that they were faithful to you, you know, which may seem like an exception in the land.
That's good.
You probably get to this, but some people kind of see Samson as a little bit of an embodiment of Israel, right? Where
No, go ahead. We can do it now.
Faithful fathers, you know, but then the next generation has a choice. When they live by the Spirit of God, good things happen. When they live by their own desires, adulterous desires, in the case of Israel.
No, that's good. Anything else that strikes you about the parents? Kind of an open-ended question.
The angel comes to the woman twice instead of the man.
Okay.
I don't know what that means.
That is interesting. I don't... anybody have any thoughts about why that is?
I didn't understand.
He said the angel comes to the wife twice and not to the man. he does later, yeah. He's the
angel appeared to Mary, so I don't know.
True.
Well, she has... He had special instructions for the woman if she wasn't to eat the grape either, or the wine.
That's a good point. So maybe it was more specific to the instructions that she had to take heed of. That would certainly impress upon her more than if it went to the man and then he then gave her the instruction.
So.
Less likely to just do it, but if you saw an angel, you'd probably be more... impressed with the outcome, I would think. So
it was a small family. I mean, it was a very tiny family.
Yeah.
It wasn't, I think if you look back to previous Egypt, for example, you know, there's some questions to his lineage, etc. But this one's fairly clear that he is the son of this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And from an early age, he's talking about, way back in the beginning, we talked about how one is elected to be a judge. It looks like from the very beginning, he is going to deliver them from the Philistine. So that's kind of unique in my mind, because usually it's much later during the course of that person's life that they become enlisted to be the deliverer, or elected, I guess. But this one is a long-term plan for this person from birth to...
Yeah, you see God's plan in this one in advance.
Yeah, yeah.
Very good. Alright. So let's talk a little bit about the angel. How does the angel describe himself? Or I guess, how does he name himself?
Wonderful.
All right, and then in the class material, it references... thank you. Yep, Isaiah 9:6. Mm-hmm. She wants to flip over there. For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. All right, so what do we make of that?
I don't know, but in the American standards, when he asks questions, not states that that's what I mean.
Okay.
Seeing is wonderful.
Okay.
He says, seeing it is a wonderful question. Oh. It's not a statement.
The alternate translation is secret. I would just borrow from that one. So, wonderful might mean a thing of wonder we wonder about.
Yeah. Well, that was the first thing that came to my mind is, in the way we use it in English or in our vernacular, wonderful is, you know, used more as like great, that kind of thing. But if you kind of break it really down, it's full of wonder and amazement, and so it comes across as a much bigger term than I think than we use it on a more regular basis.
So I don't know if you can apply this to the animal head.
I would agree with that.
But it's speculation.
Sure.
Another definition of that Hebrew word is incomprehensible.
Okay. Any other translations have something different? Beyond understanding, okay?
So you should not ask for a name because you cannot comprehend it.
I agree with Ken. I don't know that I would necessarily apply it specifically to the role of Jesus or anything along those lines. But it for me, it really drives home just what a big image and how grand an angel is. You know, if you think about an angel coming to earth and giving you a set of instructions to take upon for your life, to do on behalf of your child or whatever it may be, I think you'd believe it. Mm-hmm. You know, just because of that impression he would make.
You seem to know his reaction. We're going to die.
Yeah.
I was going to say, her reaction was like, no, we're not, because he came and he instructed us.
Mm-hmm.
And as I reread this, I was like, oh, like the whole thing with him, I mean, ascending to the air. I mean, that's just. And, like, to me, like, it's another. I think they had the right heart because they had all these questions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they didn't hear it. Like, they didn't, like. I mean, God's. Help them to see what he wants them to see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Gideon.
Yeah. No, it's good. Any other thoughts on the interaction between the angel and the parents?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we have Samson is born. What two things are here in the text in 24 and 25 that we see as kind of special here for Samson?
Blessed
Jehovah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the Lord blessed him, and what else do we have there in following in 25? Okay, so the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him. So we're going to see that phrase several times as we move forward with Samson. Each time something really big happens, we get to see that the Spirit of the Lord is upon him. And it came in power, you'll see in later verses here. All right, anything else about Samson's pre-birth and past and just before we get into some of the story here? Okay, so Danny gave me a ton of photos and maps and stuff to kind of give you some placement on where stuff is really happening for Samson, kind of brings it into the picture. So we're over here in Zora, which is where he lives, and then as we travel over for his wedding and those sorts of things, you'll see we head up over there to Timnah, which is where we're going to end up here for the majority of the remaining in the story. And you see it in a big valley. And there's an alternate view. I kind of like this one. It's probably a little small for you guys over there. Kind of give you an idea just how far he goes for an assortment of stuff. Zora is here. Tim is here, and then when we get a little farther into the story, he's going to come all the way over here to get those garments. So if you can imagine the rage that he's in as he heads over there, that's a long way to go. It's an intent to do something. So you think you'd cool down by the time you got over there? Not necessarily so. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Samson and his selection for himself. So what does he base his initial decision here on? We're in chapter 14 now. So. Outward appearance, right. So he sees this woman, and what does he say to his parents?
Get her for me.
So he likes what he sees and has decided that this is the woman for him. And this is where you kind of really get a good picture of his parents and their desire to help him grow into the man he needs to be and to try to continue to shape him in his life. And what's their response?
Can't you find some lady below your brethren?
Yeah. So They're trying to keep him within the Israelite family. Obviously, that's something that's been a commandment to them, that they're to not go outside of the family. And yet, still, how does he respond?
Get her for me.
Yeah. Same thing again. I think he's a little driven. Get her for me. She's the right one for me.
Verse 4.
Yep.
Is God making him do this, or he made a circumstance, or is it just using Samson's character, or what?
All right, I'll sidestep that one. What does everyone think?
It's from the Lord.
Yeah?
Well, he's going to deliver them from the Philistines, so they have to have somebody, some means of getting him, I mean, because they're clearly a powerful group of people. Right, so if you just try to confront them head on, that's probably not going to end well. So, go and get an insider. Makes sense.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, God's using Samson just as he is, and takes advantage of that, and you know, interacts him with the Philistines and creates opportunity that way.
Yeah. So
one thing to watch for, and I don't know that it works all the way through, but you can see the Spirit of Jehovah moves him in verse 25 of 13. And then it moves him again when the lion roars later. It does not move him here to go and be attracted to that woman. So you can kind of look at the events of his life and see his God's Spirit driving him. And, you know, not saying that he doesn't get himself into a mess in which the Spirit of Jehovah, you know, motivates him to do something. But that might be one way to look at it.
That's good.
I don't know if God necessarily led him to do this, but he did it, and it was just, I mean, we see the end, and it took this to get us to where he needed to be. So I sort of liken it like to Moses, Joseph going down to Egypt. You know, God allowed it to happen. He didn't intervene. But he needed to go to Egypt, and so this was the way for him to get there. And so this is the way for Samson to end up doing what he did.
In verse 4, it says, his father, my version says, his father and mother did not know that it was from the Lord, for he was seeking an opportunity against the Philistines. Is that he, God, was seeking an opportunity, or he, Samson, was seeking an opportunity?
I have a capital H too, so.
Absolutely.
Now we can get into discrepancy of the little H versus the big H.
Yeah.
All right, any other thoughts on that one? All right, so is this a wise choice for him?
Probably not.
But then we also get to see that, you know, God is going to work out his plan just the way it is, and even though it may not have been the best decision for him. Okay, so what happens next? What takes them over to Timnah then? So they're going to get married. So, and along the way, what happens? The lion attacks, and as Marty pointed out, this is the second time we get to see that the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. This time, it says the Spirit of the Lord came on him in power. And how did he handle the lion?
He
tore him apart. So,
I like that it says, at least mine says, the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him.
Okay, good.
And just during
Now I'm looking across at my translation to see what the other one said.
Well, imagine it had to happen pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Came upon him mightily is another one. So, all right, so he handled the line with his bare hands. So, you look like you want to say something, Ken.
Well, this also shows that he seems not to have taken the Nazarite vow seriously, because, you know, he was in contact with the dead body, but he just still going like this, you know, without the cleansing, the purification ritual.
Yeah, doesn't talk about any of the things that he would have needed to do after handling the body.
Well, when they were in battle that killed people, did they go through all that purification process? I mean,
and was the goat dead when he left him?
Or the
lion.
I mean,
if he tore the lion apart, yeah. Tore the lion apart.
He was killing the lion.
Yeah.
He probably didn't poke it after it was dead.
Well, and how we talk to ourselves about what we've done.
Sure.
There was still whatever happened to a line with the torn part.
I think that was a matchup of how the line is.
Right.
I think it's different coming across a dead body, animal or human, that has begun to putrefy, than being the one, the instrument to make it be dead.
Yeah.
Right.
Which
is go. What happened
later,
in the
it was, yeah.
Losing control.
I'll get to your mention. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Everyone's now going to turn in.
Well, even ignoring the fact that the lion was a dead animal, he was wandering about a bunch of grapes in the vineyards of Timnah. So it's like, even if he didn't get unclean by the lion, he was getting unclean
by
the grapes.
Yeah,
yeah, that's a big heads up right there.
He's the honey out of the
dead. Yeah. So at, I thought it was interesting that as he approached the vineyard was when the lion came in the first place. I thought that was interesting. But yeah, he's about to be at a feast, more than likely with lots of drinking, so there's not a good situation for a Nazarite to be in. He's in the vineyard, not a good situation, not a place that he should be putting himself in the first place. So good point. So, Danny, do you know, that's an interesting question, I don't know if anybody else knows either, but in battle, following a battle, is there a cleansing process?
I'm pretty sure there is. I mean, the Old Testament law and stuff gets pretty detailed. I made a note.
So if you keep reading number 6 after that section through verse 9, there's as many verses about what to do if you touch a dead body. You have to shave your hair off and start all over again.
Yeah, I knew that part had to happen. I was just curious if battle or something along those lines was a separate concept from that.
I think we have pretty clear indication that Samson didn't seem to take his Nazarite vows as seriously as the parents were instructed for him. I mean, he has a bit of a rebellious child or only child syndrome. I mean, again, there are parts of Samson that we are not to emulate, right? I mean, it was lust that drove him to this Temanite woman. I mean, that, it says he liked the sight of her. Again, he's a frustration to his parents, because they have tried to raise him right.
My point, too, was we had a discussion last night. Was he knew he wasn't supposed to be that honey because he didn't tell his parents where he was from.
Yeah. True.
That could be. If you look at that, his parents were very specific about the vow they took on his behalf, right? But if he doesn't own that vow, then he's not. All he's really going to do is sort of conceal his behavior and just sort of be a good line. But if he doesn't really own it, then he's just going to do whatever he can to demonstrate to his parents that he, is on board.
Yeah, you could almost see like a Nazarite on the outside and not on the inside.
Yeah, so I think there is a vow, and his parents take it very serious, but since it wasn't initiated from within himself, it's going to be, I think, in his mind, he doesn't really, he's not going to honor it as strongly as if he personally initiated the vow.
Sure. I think it immediately thinks of an example in, as a parent, we can initiate lots of things on behalf of our children, but if they don't put it in their own heart, it's not going to stick the way it should. So, all right, so let's get a little bit into the feast before we run out of time. Okay, so we've got a wedding feast. Let's is that an ordinary thing? Is that normal? Is that what usually happens? Right, so what's different in this one?
They order a lot of taxes.
So he's been given how many companions? 30. That's a lot of people. What do y'all think of that? What's the...
It makes me think of they were there to keep an eye on him.
Okay.
Because he was a mighty man.
Yeah.
Well, but it's Philistines and Hebrews, right? At this point, I don't know, are they under the control of the Philistines?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you want to make sure that this isn't just some opportunity to try to bend this on the Hebrew people.
Yep.
Does that indicate
his appearance? His parents or their parents? His appearance. I get that impression in other places. I'm not. Yeah. Okay, so he's got a lot of.
Verse 11 says, when they saw him.
Yeah. I was about to say, I know I saw it somewhere that it was.
And then they brought the word.
Is it companions in every translation?
All right. Anybody have anything other than companions? I have it in all four of my translations here.
Yes, the bridegroom is kind of referenced.
Okay, so what happens after that? We got the companions there. They're having their feast. And what happens? Alright, so Samson gives them a riddle. And so he says, if you can give me an answer within 7 days of the feast, I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 sets of clothes. But if you can't, then you can give me 30 linen garments and 30 sets of clothes. Alright, so we've got a wager here on behalf of this riddle. And so what's the riddle?
Referencing something, you know, to do with the lion and the honey.
Yep. Alright, so out of the eater something to eat, out of the strong something sweet. Alright, so so the question in the homework assignment, was there anything wrong in telling a riddle to the young men of the Philistines? I think that answers the question, doesn't it? The riddle itself, not so much a problem. The wager, not so much.
I don't think they're really thinking the way we would think of them.
Sure.
By the fact that they're like, so we're going to burn your house down in your daughter.
Yeah.
I don't think they were all friendly with each other.
Yeah, I get the impression that these companions were given to more watch over him and to keep him in line.
Verse 20 says a little more about them too. And that is, one of them took the wife, you know, and he had used as his friend, kind of like.
Yeah, so it gives you another impression of Samson, kind of a loner. He doesn't have his own friends come over with him. He's given a bunch from the Philistines. Those are his handed to him friends.
And, you know, I guess, again, you know, the Lord's given this occasion, but it's like verse 11, they saw him and said, here are 30 companions. And then it's sort of like he then poses this riddle so that you almost... It seems like, you know, Samson knew why they had given him 30 companions. And giving a riddle that really only one person knew the answer to, there was a provoking of those 30 companions. And I don't know that he mentally said, well, if I lose, I'll go kill 30, because you kind of get a feel that he had a temper. But it seems almost that that riddle is partially a response to them looking at him and being a little afraid of him and giving him 30 companions.
Gotcha. Interesting. Okay. All right, so they aren't able to figure it out. What do? They threaten his wife. What do they threaten her with? They're going to burn her and her father's household. So that's more than just threatening her. They're threatening her whole family. And so what does she do then in turn? So she tries to get it out of Samson rather than telling Samson, which I think is interesting. Rather than going to him with her problem, she tries to solve the problem by deceit, I guess. And she uses sobbing and crying, and what does he do?
He gives in.
He gives in. All right, so we get another little glimpse into Samson's downfall here. Just like we saw in the way he chose his wife, we also see that gives in to her and what she needs there and getting that answer. And so she gives them the answer and they in turn win the wager. So what does Samson do? What's his response?
If you had the power of my head, you wouldn't know the riddle.
Okay, so what does that mean?
sudden you subterfuge to come and get the answer out of my wife.
Gotcha. So you've tricked me.
Yeah.
All right. So we can
take vengeance.
So he's very angry. All right. So in verse 19, we see again. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon him in power. And what does he do?
That's a good question.
Scale.
Yeah, there's no scale on that one.
Any thoughts, Dave?
50 miles.
Yeah. That's a good weight.
Yeah, especially walk.
Yeah.
Especially here to gain.
Yeah. How long is a normal distance that's somebody would cover?
I mean, that would be.
The day journey?
Yeah.
So he had all day to be angry and head all the way over there. And so then he struck down 30 of their men, stripped them of their belongings, and gave their clothes to those who had explained the riddle. So rather than cashing in from his own coffers to make this happen, he goes over to their own people and takes it from them and gives it to them. And how does he finish off chapter 14 here? What else does he do when he was still angry?
He went home.
Yep, he went home. Mm-hmm. So so rather than staying there with his wife, he heads back to his father's house. And it says, and Samson's wife was given to the friend who had attended him at his wedding. So, or companion who had been his friend. Alright, so anything else? Any other thoughts on the riddle, the answer, and then his response there? Alright, so Samson says, later on, at the time of the wheat harvest, Samson took a young goat, and what was he doing? He was going to go back to his wife. So it was a chunk of time. He goes back. He's brought a goat. And what happens when he gets there? What does he find out?
He doesn't have a wife.
Finds out he doesn't have a wife anymore. So the father who was giving her away, what's his excuse? What does he tell Samson? Said, I didn't think you were coming back. I thought you hated her. So I've given her to your friend. Here's her lovely sister. Would you like her instead? And so Samson is once again not so happy. And what does he do? How does he respond this time? He responds with animal cruelty. Okay. So how does he explain it first? What is he in verse 3? He you can see his justification.
He's given me basically permission to get revenge, to seek revenge.
Yep. So now he feels justified, and he says, now I'm going to really harm them. And so what does he go out and do?
Three hundred foxes.
I
can catch 300 foxes.
Yeah. I think you have to be pretty quick to catch 300 foxes. Yeah. And then you tie their tails together and then attach a torch. And the purpose behind it all was to... So nothing more exciting than watching two foxes try to get away from each other, running wild through a wheat field. Which just basically starts a big blaze. So he uses these foxes to basically burn all of their fields apart. And the Philistines then, in turn, so now we're going back and forth and back and forth. We see that between Samson and the Philistines. And how do they then respond?
He killed his, I guess, former wife and her dad.
Okay, so they then take revenge, and they burn her and her father to death, and quickly before everybody gets up and leaves, what is Samson's response then to that?
He again states his intent to get vengeance.
Yep.
Slaughters many. He
says, I won't stop until I get my revenge on you. And that is the big dun-dun-dun before next class. All right, thank you, everybody. Thanks, Brian, for your comment.
It was like a 7-minute ceremony.
Yeah.
Good job.
Thanks, Daniel. So, I think the map is
Yeah.
Got that down.